The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by YouTube TV. Try it free today at youtube.com/NBA23. New users only. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny. Every week during the offseason, Mina and her expert guests will get you ready for the fall with team-by-team previews, offensive and defensive rankings, and more. That's the Mina Kimes Show. Listen where you are listening to this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week where we have a guest join us. You know how to start calling him 4-star Joe. Joe from Missouri City. You know what I'm saying? Joe got a lot of hater in him. So I feel like he'd be going on to iTunes and throwing up the 4 stars.
Hey, Bo, last time I saw you had hair, what happened, man? What happened?
What happened was, I took my foot off of y'all's necks. That's what happened.
Okay.
I had been around a while.
I've been busy. I didn't know what had happened. You know what I'm saying? I didn't get invited to the live show. You know what I'm saying?
First time I've been seeing you. I had to give a lot of y'all, you know what I'm saying, a chance to feel like y'all was coming up on your boy. I realized that when I had to hear, I was like, damn, y'all thought y'all had it, and then y'all didn't. But man, Dan Le Batard actually said that. He was like, didn't you grow the hair out? You look like Job Shaft. You right, dog. That's it. So I decided to ease up the pressure just a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
I'm gonna hold it down while you went back home. I'm gonna just hold it.
That's cool. I appreciate you holding that down. And I mean, if I could grow a full head of gray hair, I would. You're right. And I just can't. And that's what it is. It's cool.
Okay. You know, look, man, this is just a sign of growth and maturity right here, brother. You know, you don't have to, you know, I mean, you get lucky. You can have, you won't get gray hair up there. You know what I'm saying? You know, maybe in the beard.
It might be. At some point, I can be like, you look like you just got through eating a bunch of donuts. You know what I'm saying? I understand that.
You know what?
The people can't see it on the YouTube, but you get a little closer. You know what I'm saying?
I have enough respect for myself to not cheat. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just leaving it out here for people, you know?
No, I say, in real life, I don't cheat. Oh, gay theory, fraudulence. There was fraudulence.
Really? Oh, see, look at you, man. Look, man, people.
The thing about it was, I didn't ask for the fraudulence. It was an executive decision made by professional hair care folks. Any barber I had, they decided, okay, we're going to go ahead and put a little fiction in there. And I was just like, you know what? I'll ride it out. That's fine.
Hey, look, man, sometimes you got to do my mother and my wife both want me to die. They want me to do the Ronald Reagan thing. And I'm just like, I have more respect for myself.
No,
I'm sorry.
No, I know why they want you to do it, though.
Yeah. Baby, you'll look so much younger and all that. First of all, it's never been anything like that in my life. But anyway, that's just where we at now.
They ain't worried about making you look younger. That ain't what it is. They know what I know, what you know, that everybody else know. They love that salt and pepper.
Hey, man,
I don't know what your mama's investment is, but I feel like your wife, she tried to incept you. Is that like that's what that would sound like? Oh no, that gray hair looks so bad. She loved that gray.
What I told her though, I was just like, you know, you're the one that made me grow this hair out in the first place. I didn't even know I had this power. You know what I'm saying? I was like, if I'd had this hair in college, I would have been a real problem. You know what I'm saying?
All right, now. Joel is hosting the latest season, Slow Bird. It is on Clarence Thomas. We are absolutely going to get to that. I listened to the first episode with everybody else. They gave your boy a little sneak peek action at episode 2. That new ain't came out yet. You know what I'm saying? I got a hold of that. We're going to talk about that. But the world kind of blew up yesterday with the LIV Golf PGA Tour. They're calling it a merger, right? And I guess this is how it goes with mergers. But that Saudi Arabia man gonna be the one that's the chairman.
They own the PGA now.
I was talking to Spencer about this yesterday. The Saudis leveraged a brand that is worth literally nothing. Right? Like, what is LIV Golf worth? They don't have any with their broadcast deal. They own the CW. You know what I'm saying? Homeboys Out of Space is on UPN and ain't even CW. You know what I'm saying? They on the CW. Nobody's watching their broadcast. Like, that name doesn't attract anybody. And it's their guy that's now running the new, honestly, golf cartel. This don't even feel like it's really legal, if we're going to keep it real. Like, it feels real cartelly. But they bought golf. is basically what I'm saying here.
Well, that's what I was going to say, but money, and you know this as the economist, whatever. Did you even know that the PGA Tour was for sale? Like, I didn't even know that was something you could buy. You know what I mean?
I didn't. I mean, I guess the way they playing it is like, it's not so much that you can buy this as much as, I guess they got, like I say, it felt like a cartel situation, right? Where they've decided that we're going to like organize this whole golf thing and bring it all together. But there's a part in this that I feel like hasn't been discussed enough, which is everybody's making this argument about growing the game of golf, right? And that this partnership will help grow golf. As part of what Mickelson and the other cats that went over there to play with Liv, what they would talk about is the idea of growing golf. Golf has never wanted to grow. Like, it's not as though there hasn't been opportunities for golf to grow. In fact, this is all you need to know. In the Tiger Woods era, like from 97 on, Black participation in golf decreased.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow. That's right. That is jarring. I had no idea. Are you serious?
It decreased. Yeah. You know, and I think that with golf and Black people in particular, what had been lost is there had always been a tradition of Black people playing golf, right? Like my buddy James worked with me on Game Theory. James is a golf guy. Like, that's what he does. And he started playing golf with his granddaddy, right? And he'd go to the, you know, go to this course in South Central, well, I guess it's South LA now, but go to his course in South LA, and it's all them Black dudes that's out there. When Jordan was out there in trouble with that dude that was taking his money playing golf, Slim Bowler, it was a brother named Slim.
Didn't he have a curl too? I think he had a curl too.
I would assume.
He did, but anyway.
Right, but Black people play golf, but Tiger Woods was the chance for you to be like, yo, we're going to take golf. And we're going to take it to all these places and increase participation. And what they did was increase TV ratings. Like, they wanted more people to watch it, but they never been really that interested in growing the game. It is a game that excludes.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Everything about golf suggests exclusivity to me. Like, it's prohibitive. Like, you can't get into places. Like, I mean, they have public courses, but not as many as they used to. So,
but yeah, but see, and that's the thing. The not as many as they used to is the part. But golf actually is far more accessible than people like give it credit for. You can't go play on them courses that you see on TV for cheap. And you can't go play three times a week necessarily. But there are a lot of places that you can go get you some clubs at the pawn shop or whatever it is. Like, you ain't going to have the best stuff necessarily. But there's a lot of places you could go and you could play golf in a lot of little towns or whatever it is, especially places where land isn't scarce. You know, there's a lot of places that you could go and do it, but ain't nobody asking you to come. Right. Like, when I see the first tee and things like that, charities that use golf as kind of outreach to lower income folks. It's always Black people that's out here running that. Like, you could grow this. There's always been time to grow this game. They've never wanted to do that. And so when I look at this for the PGA, like for the players, I guess it may wind up okay because maybe now they'll get boatloads of money like those other dudes. But why? It's a monopoly now. They ain't got to give you no boatloads of money. You ain't got nowhere else to go. You ain't really got no alternative.
Yeah, those prices this are fixed. That's where you're going to go to make that money up again. I mean, does the Hooters Tour still exist? I don't think so.
Man, let me tell you, them Phil Mickelson cats, they inadvertently hit on the lick, right? Like, they went over there, they got that money, and now they're going to come back over here with the squad.
But, Monty, you talked about this one other time, and I can't remember the context. You talk about how when you work for somebody, they hold your career in their hands, your reputation as well. Man, the PGA last year sent these dudes out there to, like, vigorously talk about the Live Tour and like how they did not want to take part in it and how it was this abomination and all this other stuff. And now a year later, man, that dude cashes out and now you got to go to your new bosses with that stuff on tape. I mean, it really has to. I mean, those people have to be extremely mad. I would love to see those group chats today. I turned down that money. You made me turn down that money. And now I got to go to these people now.
The buddy for the PGA had a meet with all them golfers and they gave it to him. Boy, you know how scared I'd be to be in a room full of all them mad white people. A bunch of mad ass real white men. Do you understand? They either rich or they really like some, like, oh, you know, I you know, do you have any clue what I had to do to get here? Tice, I don't want to be in that. Anytime it's been a room of that many mad white folks. And by the way, this time with a legitimate point.
Absolutely.
Woo!
I mean, bro, you potentially cost me tens of millions of dollars. And now I have to go out here and look like a hypocrite. Because, again, where are these people going to go? They're going to have to go in a manner of speaking, I'm not trying to say it's just anything, kiss the ring. They're going to have to kiss the ring and work for people that they have insulted publicly, which I assume these are not people that take well to being insulted publicly.
But the thing is, in fairness to the PGA people, it sounded like that lawsuit was not going to go their way. And that's the only way that this makes any sense I think the key to, again, remember again, the Saudi man is in charge. Like if the Saudi dude, the right-hand man to MBS, crown prince of Saudi Arabia, if that dude's in charge, then that means that they won. Like this wasn't simply the PGA just being like, hey, let's make a deal. This sounds like these folks housed them. They came in there and they housed them. They took the whole thing. And when I talk about the fact that I don't think that this can grow the game, what Liv was going for is to make this even richer. Right. Like what, you know, what the Saudis seem to be doing with all the stuff they're doing is they want to be respected by the other rich people. Right. They don't want to be treated like backwards rich people. They want to be treated like British rich people. They want to be treated like American rich people. They want to be treated like white rich people is what we're saying here. Right. And when you look at the way that Middle Eastern rich gets down, whether it be the Saudis, what you see in like Dubai, what you saw coming in Qatar is the height of luxury, right? Mm-hmm. And these were supposed to be, yeah, they out here playing golf in shorts and all this stuff. But you know, they plan is to turn this into take this golf thing and make it even more fresher, even more exclusive. And none of that is going to grow golf.
Right. Right, right. Well, I mean, the way you're describing it sounds like Tidal for golf. Like, you remember when Tidal came out, like, we're going to make it better for artists. Artists are going to make a lot more money. You know what I'm saying? And we're going to really grow this thing, this streaming service, whatever. And then all of a sudden, it's like, hey, actually, the dynamics here actually don't really seem to be changing quite as much as we think.
But here's the difference. I say this as someone who now uses Tidal. The difference is Tidal ultimately had something for people who really, 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 really are into music, right? And there is a superior sound quality and stuff like that. Like, so they went from trying to act like they was the revolution to just being like, we're actually offering a premium product. My thing with the Live Tour is, since what they're selling is not golf in a participatory sense, it's just golf in a sense to view it, the sophisticated golf fan is not getting anything extra out of these people now being involved with it, right? So I felt like Tidal could find their place. This is just golf now, and it just looks terrible for everybody. And you hit on it, man, the look of hypocrisy. Because if I'm Phil Mickelson, everybody got to apologize to me.
Oh, man. I mean, he's got to be end zone celebration to the mug, bro. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know he just was like lighting up a cigar, you know what I'm saying, yesterday. It's like, all right, I'm just going to wait for these texts to roll in. It's all good. You know what I'm saying? Whenever you want to stop by, let me know.
But all the people that gave the blues to Phil, and honestly, everybody was so mad at Phil, but Phil just said what was implicit in what everybody else said, right? Yeah, they be acting up over there. However, they got this bread, and I'm going to take this bread, okay? Right. That's what the PGA, the whole PGA just said, regardless of how they got put in that position, whether they got bent over it, whatever it is, right? PGA said, yeah, we know how they get down, but they are partners now.
But so my thing is, so again, we're essentially going to be watching golf as it existed prior to 2021, because these are all the same golfers. Like, nothing is actually going to change. Like, maybe there will be different prize money. There'll be better prize money for the winners. There'll be different stops on the tour. You know, they'll be able to adjust the schedules in such a way that is more favorable to the golfers. But we're actually just talking about golf. It's the same golf, right? Just really rich people are owning it, which in another way is kind of what's happening to a lot of the American economy right now, right? Well, like, I mean,
and sports in particular, man, there's a Saudi bid on Manchester United. I think Newcastle is the one they already own. There's an expectation that the next move is to get in on the tennis. They changed the rules in the NBA to make it such that sovereign wealth funds like the Saudi fund can invest in NBA teams.
Right.
They are coming. And look, this is going to be awkward for American sports, because the truth is American sports exist to celebrations of two things: masculinity and America. Like, those are that's how this goes. That's part of why this thing gets extra weird with like NBA and protest and all of this stuff, because the NFL figured it out the best. They sell the Americana more than anybody, and it's the secret impediment to the NHL because their player base is primarily not American. Like, it is not a game steeped in American tradition, because it is more Canada's game. You know what I mean? Like, it's a trick bag. But how hard you sell in America with the Saudis, especially, you know, that thing. You remember that thing that happened?
The bone saw.
Well, there's that. I was thinking about this as other as bone saw, but I wasn't living here at the time, but they tell me that one morning.
I remember on a Tuesday, I was watching on TV that day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I guess we're not going to be able to. The thing is, man, is that what all this is makes clear what is happening in the economy right now is that the rich is going to take it all, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, everything is sort of consolidating. I mean, it's not, I mean, golf isn't Twitter, but.
By the way, I mean, Twitter, heavily invested in by the Saudi public investment fund.
I see. I mean, so this is just going to be a fact of life for people. And already for people that have said, don't make your politics personal. Like, you know, if you shop at Target, if you shop at Amazon, whatever, it doesn't have to be a reflection of your values. Like, it's going to be really hard to live by your political commitments, your ethical commitments going forward, because I mean, we're all tied up in this, man.
Yo, that was my thing I was going to say. Everybody that went super hard on the LIV Golf Tour and super hard on the Saudis, and if you actually cared about watching golf, what you going to do now?
I mean, the thing is, at least they weren't watching it before. I mean, I saw something like 4,000 people watching in the middle of the day at one point. I mean...
But that's the thing. Nobody was watching. Let's say the brand was useless. The brand had absolutely no value. But all of this is so tied up now. And I tell you this, boy, for people who don't know, the four major tournaments are not tied up with the PGA Tour, right? Like, there is a disconnection between those two. I don't fully understand it, but I've heard enough people say it that I feel comfortable saying it myself, right? And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a good thing, but in a way, kind of a bad thing. And the reason that I say it's kind of a bad thing, I wanted to see some of our, and maybe this will still have to happen, right? Some of our representatives of the Saudi Public Investment Fund making that trip to their new property of the Masters. Like, I mean, I'm just imagining them down there, not just at the Masters, but walk around like they run it, because they do. They don't run it because the Masters is by itself. But wasn't, it would be great.
Where are they going to stay in Augusta? I mean, I've never been down there before.
Wherever they damn well please with the money they got. Like, well, you know, people go down there and, like, rent houses. Like, they're going to go down there and rent some kind of old plantation and be in there just kicking it.
I know. Just build something from scratch. I mean, that wouldn't be nothing for them anyway, right?
Huh. It's a good question. Yeah, they might. Yeah.
Luxury properties. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they could do something to Augusta. There's a way for Augusta to win out of this.
No, I mean, all I'm saying is this is a bigger deal than most sports media is probably improperly in the position to really evaluate. There's a hypocrisy element, and it's just kind of, you know, shakes the table or whatever it is. But this is a world story, and I think, like you said, it is a reflection of the modern capitalist state. And I don't mean the American capitalist state. I just mean overall in this. And look, they throwing money that's real hard to turn down. I mean, do 100% totally understand that.
What we're finding out is that, I mean, almost everyone has a price, right? I mean, we know that. We know that instinctively. But, I mean, the Saudis could pretty much blow past any assumptions you have about where your line and your morality are. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, how would you like $15 million more dollars?
Man. 15? But they're not talking about 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how this goes, man, but everybody better buckle up. But yes, the Phil Mickelson, what y'all got to say now?
I mean, Tiger Woods, man. I mean, I really would love to know what Tiger Woods is thinking right now. You know what I mean? It's like, man, you got me out there and embarrassed myself.
Nah. But let me tell you why. Phil Mickelson is still not going to recover from what happened.
You think so?
He'll never know. It happened. It's done. Right?
Wait, no, man. In this climate, in this new cycle,
done. It's done. Because here's why: nobody has time to go back and reevaluate. Right? Like, whatever damage Phil Mickelson incurred, it's not like the end of his career. He can never do anything. But the reputational damage that he incurred remains, even though, like, the PGA just jumped in the same hypocritical bed with him. But he is still branded. Like, they did not pull him out of the hypocritical bed. They just jumped in with him. Okay.
Right.
Tiger Woods, especially if it was Tiger Woods, the reputational concern, the way people would have jumped on and slammed him for it, people wouldn't have come around on the other end. Like, the thing we got to remember, Muhammad Ali became a beloved figure in the end. But the people who were really pissed off about him in Vietnam in the 60s didn't stop for 30 years. He had to get up there at that Olympic flame shaking, right? Before they were like, all right, we good. There's not going to be any such opportunity or moment for Phil Mickelson to do that. So for Tiger, it wasn't worth the money because the reputational concerns would have still been the same. It's Charles Barkley that need to be mad.
Charles Barkley. Oh, because he was going to be. That's right.
Look, I was on phone calls with people who were like, can we get Charles on the phone? We need to talk to him. Like, it was people calling and imploring folks who knew Charles to talk to him. And a lot of it was honestly patronizing and people believing that Charles didn't get or grasp the magnitude of it. But part of what I know people did tell Charles was, you are beloved. And people, and the thing I always said about it with Charles was, I always assume you mean well, because you and I have talked about this. Charles has said some things that I don't would never let anybody else slide for ever. But I legitimately and truly believe that his intentions were good. And if he had done that, it would be impossible for me to believe that at that point. Right.
Right.
If Charles had done that and then this comes around, then everybody else is in the same boat as him. Yes, but we lectured him. Or like, you know, like the tone in discussing this with him was like he wasn't a bright man and it was lecturing him. You don't understand what it is that you're doing, da, 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 and everything else. That's the dude that need to come out here. Because with Phil Mickelson, we was just like, all right, then f*** you, right?
Right.
But Charles, we patronize. And Charles need to be like, all right, so what you going to do now? You go up there and point your finger at them and tell them that they don't understand what it is that they was doing?
Man, I mean, I guess that's a good point, but I mean, the thing is that, I mean, I'm sort of interested in the idea that you think that Phil Mickelson is going to retain the same reputational damage 5 or 10 years from now. I just feel like we live in a society, a sort of shame-free society, and that you can outlive any controversy.
But for the people who cared.
Do you think those people are going to care in 5 years?
Yes. Okay. Because I think it's a relatively small subset of people here who cared. We're not talking about the average person. The other thing about it is Phil Mickelson is way past his prime. Unless, like, now, maybe Phil Mickelson comes out here and has his 86 Masters moment. And as an old man, he comes out there and kills it. And then that's what I said about Ali. There need to be a moment to bring him back in with those people. And I don't think there's ever going to be any such moment. He's not that well liked in the first place.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, there'll be a PGA Hall of Fame ceremony in like Qatar or something like that. And they'll bring over it and they'll do a nice little thing for Phil Mickelson and people will forget about it.
No, I think, though, and it's a shame in a way, because all he did was say the truth that nobody else would say. But he's the one that put his name on it. Like the thing I say about Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick put words on it. Marshawn Lynch sitting by the water cooler did not put words on it. He do commercials for Subway. Like
Marshawn Lynch is about to be in a movie, a kid's movie now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? So
Mickelson put the words on it.
Right.
And I don't think there's coming back.
I hear you. I hear you on that. But I guess I'm dubious of the idea that it will last with him. Or the thing is, he's already made the decision. Don't matter. Y'all, I got paid.
Yeah, maybe. But I guess what I'm saying is this. In my eyes, if it wasn't going to last for him, it wouldn't have been the thing it was in the first place. And it still lasts till now. It's not like people have let it slide now. They don't talk about it all the time because there's not a lot of reason to talk about him. But right. if it was going to be let it slide point, it's been like a year and a half.
That's true. I mean, that's true. I mean, and that does outlast sort of the natural news cycle. You think that people let it go. But I just think it's so fresh in everybody's mind to the extent that people care. But again, 5, 10 years from now,
out. Joe, it's not fresh. It's a year and a half.
But things have happened again. Was anybody talking about this prior to this? I mean, with Phil Mickelson.
But that's my point. There's nothing happening with him to like freshen this up and make it to where it's like, oh, we talk about this other thing now rather than talk about that with him.
That's fair. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I just think that people are going to move past it quicker than you think. And I don't think that it's going to last. And also,
tell me this, in your idea of shame-free society, you would have thought it would have passed in a year and a half, right?
It's tough, right? I mean,
you would have thought it would have passed in a year and a half, right?
I'm trying to think of who just got a job recently. Well, I was going to say Kendall Briles, but I mean,
but see, that's the wrong standard, right? Because yeah, you might be able to get a job. Like it's not the full law, but there still is reputational damage. Like Kendall Briles will never be a head coach. Ever. If Kendall Bryles was ever going to be a head coach, he'd be a head coach by now. That last name will stop him from ever being a head coach. There's reputational damage. I mean, his daddy can't get a job nowhere.
I mean, you know what? Okay. All right. You walk me down that path. I can see that. I can see that. And maybe it's not quite the right analogy because that is a much different, they're being accused of something much different. But I just think that the people around that universe, they don't, you know what I mean? Like the people that for whom it would matter, it's going to matter much less. And I already don't think they sort of don't care. But yeah, that's just.
I hear you, but I think they held on to it for a while, man.
A year and a half is a long time now. Now it is. It didn't used to be, but it is.
That's what I'm saying. It's not like, I just don't know. I just don't think there's enough to, like, as much as we talk about there being shame free, he may not have any shame, but there, I mean, but people, you can't say that this is a society where people don't stay mad.
Fair point. But people also get mainstreamed back into polite society much quicker than they used to.
Once people forget about the thing, Mickelson's right. thing wasn't forgettable.
Right. Not yet.
I'm telling you, people are never going to be like, oh yeah, he did say that. Like, this is top line of the Phil Mickelson resume.
Man, I guess, man. As a person who's not a golf fan, who does not follow golf that closely, when I think of Phil Mickelson, I don't think of that. But again, like, you're right. The people that, who are always going to hold on to that. And yeah, people feel important.
I'm just saying there is damage that can't be undone. That doesn't have to mean absolutely that he's been ruined or that he can't show his face anywhere. But for Tiger Woods, the magnitude of the damage that would have been done is not worth it to him to get another $1 billion.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, Tiger Woods means something totally different than Phil Mickelson.
That's what I'm saying.
Same with Charles Barkley. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Wow, we got you here. What are we on? Slow Burn Season 9?
Eight. Yeah, man.
Slow Burn Season 8. Thomas. This was all Clarence Thomas. First of all, number one, for people who don't realize this, the decisions on what to do on something like this are made way far in advance. So you just stumble into gold that all this Clarence Thomas stuff started coming out as you were working on this. Like, did it make it? I'm sure it made it better for the ability to promote the podcast, but I feel like it had to make it harder in the actual making.
The timing actually was perfect because I went down to Savannah, Georgia.
I got robbed there once.
In late March, early April. You got robbed there once. Oh, we didn't talk about this, did we?
I could have swore I had, because that's anytime somebody brings up Savannah, I got robbed there once.
Man, why you think they thought you were food like that?
Because I got set up.
What? You talk about me being a four-star hater. You got somebody that hate you enough to set you up?
Nah, I was a target of opportunity, but I got set up nonetheless. It's a long story. Play the music.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
Well, yeah, I got robbed in Savannah once, but you was down there. What was going on?
Yeah, man. So anyway, I went down there before any of these latest revelations had come out. So there wasn't the same sort of heightened security around his mom's house or whatever. So I was able to kind of get down there, and then the news breaks just in time after I don't need to go down there anymore. And it's, you know, perfect time sort of line up with the rollout of this season. So it actually has worked out really, really well. The people that weren't going to talk to us, they already weren't going to talk to us. So, you talked about timing. Yeah, man, I write really, really lucky in that way. I won't deny that. But I mean, shoot, man, that's part of news, bro. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes you catch a wave.
But one thing that's interesting in the way that this has been produced is that hearing you, because I admire you like journalist for real, because I ain't built to just be knocking on strangers' doors, man. I don't even know how you are. I used to be like, I'm not built for it because I'm from Texas. Somebody might smoke you, but you from Texas, you know, somebody might smoke you too. But you like going and talking to like Clarence Thomas's mama, you got to talk to his sister for a little bit. And it's just kind of wild to me, like this idea. And I understand it on a number of levels, and I'm not judging these people because I don't, you know, anybody involved because I don't know them like that. But it's kind of wild that he and the Supreme Court, they just posted up in Savannah.
Hey, but mine, that, you know, so you, in the first episode, you hear me go to the door and they open it, and I'm like, oh, I think I got the wrong house. There's two reasons for that. One, I'm thinking, ain't no way his family still lives in this house, which is a perfectly fine house. But that's the house my grandparents would live in. You know what I'm saying? And and the other piece of it, the woman that answered the door, not a black woman. So I was kind of confused. I'm like, oh, okay, this couldn't be Clarence Thomas's mama house, right? But anyway, it was a great granddaughter-in-law that opened the door. So, you know what I'm saying? So you know how that works. But anyway, so yeah, that was why I didn't understand what was going on there. But yeah, man, it's a, you know, it's that they welcomed me in, and I don't know. You talked about knocking on people's doors, and I've read all those horrifying stories about knocking on people's doors and people hurting you. And like that has gotten more lodged in my brain in the last couple of months than it ever did before, because part of my journalism background training is just going on doors, man, and getting people to talk, you know?
Yeah, but I even without the gun threat, right? Like just the, I'm about to walk up on this stranger we about to talk. I ain't built like that. Like it really impresses me. When hearing it actually in action, and you know, figuring out in the quick moment how to get these people to just come let you, and you coming in like wanting to talk about Clarence. And so, you know, I guess there's some people like, I don't know. And it got to be somebody like, hell yeah, what you want to know?
I mean, the thing is, you got to be careful of people that are too willing to want to talk, and like, hey, why you want to talk about this so bad? You know what I mean? Because you don't know what sort of agenda they have. But yeah, man, you know, I'm not brave, you know, so I don't think this is courageous or whatever. You know, I guess I fundamentally have faith that ain't nobody gonna hurt me. You know what I mean? And I don't know what that's about. But I mean, man, I've gotten kicked out of Josh Rosen's front stoop. You know what I'm saying? like I said, I've been kicked out of better homes than some of the ones I saw obviously down in Savannah. But yeah, man, it's the kind of journalism that I don't probably won't, you know. It won't exist in 20, 30 years. I mean, it's people do aggregation or whatever, but to the extent that if you show up to people's homes, man, it's really hard to turn down somebody that wants to talk to you if they show up at your front door. Like, I know a lot of people don't answer doors or whatever anymore. And, you know, we're a lot more scared of each other than we used to be, it seems like, culturally over the last 20 years or so. But I think if it's really hard if somebody comes to you and they're really serious about telling the story of your life or somebody who cares about life and they show up at your front door, it's really hard to turn them down, man. People want to be heard. People want to talk. The thing is, you just got to figure out how to get them to get there. Don't get comfortable enough.
Well, is there anything that really struck you in particular about the Thomases?
So I don't know about you. When I was growing up, Clarence Thomas was, shorthand for Uncle Tom. Right.
His nickname at our house among some people was Uncle, in fact, Clarence.
But we got people that call him Uncle Justice. You know what I'm saying? Uncle Justice, right about where I'm from, too. Yes. And people that don't remember Emerge magazine, like sort of the lasting image I have, it was a black business. Actually, it was a black public interest magazine in the 90s. And it had these caricatures of Clarence Thomas on the cover. One is Aunt Jemima, or sort of like an Aunt Jemima themed figure, and another is a lawn jockey. So as I'm growing up, I'm thinking, oh, this is one of the worst black guys there is. You know what I'm saying? Like, he couldn't be part of the community. And the thing that is shocking is that I actually was kind of surprised at the connections he has to black folks, man. Like, he is of black folks. He has lots of black friends. This is a dude who was against interracial relationships as recently as the year before he got married to Jenny Thomas. I guess the fact that he was rooted in the black community the way that he is, and has some affinity for a lot of people, and people that have affinity for him that don't even share his political ideology. That part of it really surprised me. But
I've been trying to tell y'all, though. I told you I had that man figured out on that stuff.
Wait, Stone, tell me what? Which
part? No, just, I always thought that people misunderstood Clarence in relationship to blackness and whiteness, right?
Okay.
And it's clear from where we are in the first two episodes of this, and maybe something changes, but Clarence ain't no fan of the white man, right? Yeah. He just has some weird down south kind of self-hatred type stuff that he quibbles with. But what I didn't expect from listening to the first two episodes was the affection that you talk about, though, for like a lot of blackness and like that wing of thinking. I think that the lesson that I'm getting for you in the first two episodes that I think is important that gets lost is there is a streak of conservatism within black communities, southern black communities in particular. Problem is Republicans more than it is the idea of being somewhat conservative.
But Monty, you know, we both know this. There are a lot of black conservatives that does not have anything to do with how many black Republicans they are. You know what I'm saying? Because people know. I mean, black people in the South. The thing is always sort of really infuriated me when people talk about black people in the South, or they'll say, you know, they're wedded to this party, or they're not thinking for themselves or whatever. I'm like, don't you think these people have experience? These have people experience with these white Republicans wherever they live and know what they want. And they have a sense of who wants the best for their communities or not. So, yeah, man. I mean, so black Clarence Thomas is of a tradition of folk like that. He's not, now he, again, you were right about the self-hatred thing, and we'll talk about that in episode three a little bit more, but this is a dude, you're right, he doesn't have a lot of faith in white people, but it's just that, you know, he shares a lot of the same political beliefs that he does. He's a fundamentally conservative person,
and his lack of faith in white people also then by extension becomes a lack of faith in white liberals and the welfare state, in effect, right? It's like the idea, there was a great part in the second episode where he says, the thing his grandfather said about why not take welfare is that once you take welfare, then the government can ask you questions that they ain't got no business ever asking you. And you should not, you know, they should not be in the place where they could do that. Where, so again, this is the benefactor that we helping y'all out. He don't trust these people enough to believe that they are helpful.
Right, right. So there's a guy, Corey Robin, an academic who wrote a book about Clarence Thomas called The Enigma of Clarence Thomas. And he says, maybe I'm giving this away a little early, whatever, but essentially that Clarence Thomas does not believe in the American project, a multiracial democracy. He doesn't believe that, desegregation was a good thing. And there are a lot of black people that actually believe that. And you know that, Bomani, there are a lot of people that it was better when we had our own communities and our own schools and our own teachers. And that is a very persuasive argument. But as a result of that, like Clarence Thomas is like, well, let's just, I mean, basically he said, the government is free to let us all be. And because he doesn't have that faith in white people, he's just like, basically black people have to figure it out. He thinks black people are better when we have to figure it out on our own. He really glorifies and the black men of the Jim Crow era, of the civil rights era. And I mean, that's a really scary thing. This is a guy that's one of the most powerful people in the world that doesn't actually fundamentally believe in multiracial democracy.
But it's also not terribly different than what his first hero after his grandfather believed in many ways. And that's Malcolm X.
Yeah.
Like Clarence Thomas is a Malcolm X devotee, though I did find it amazing that he said somebody went to Clarence's house one time and it was a Malcolm X poster. He left, came back, and it was a Rolls Royce poster.
Hey, man, he's wearing Monsanto then. He's making that money. You know what I'm saying? He's like, well, his money is actually pretty nice, as he finds out throughout the course of his life, by the way.
Yeah. But no, this is so interesting for me because like I was actually thinking that Clarence Thomas has a son from his first marriage, because his first marriage was to a black woman. Like, again, mm-hmm. we're probably blowing some of your minds with these things. But his first marriage to a black woman, and they had a kid. And I wonder in some ways if that kid, like, how he feels about people knowing that his dad is Clarence Thomas. But don't worry, nobody will ever believe your dad is Clarence Thomas, because your name is Jamal. Nobody would ever believe that Clarence Thomas named his kid Jamal.
He named that kid that intentionally. It was intentional. And he talks about it at some point that like I was, you know, I mean, that's what he's Clarence Thomas is other culture, man. It will really shock people. That's how far deep down he was. He would name his son Jamal. Right. But Man, you know, I know somebody that went to school with Jamal. I can't say who they are. And man, Clarence Thomas, man, that's a hard ass man, man. We talk about his grandfather in episode one. And in addition to Jamal Thomas wondering, like, hey man, I wonder if people, you know, do people know who my dad is? What are people thinking about my dad? I would really be curious to know what his relationship is like with his father, because Clarence Thomas was a very difficult person, a very hurt person. And I'm trying to think of how I want to say this, because I don't want to put Jamal out there like that. But he's got a lot of similarity to his grandfather, put it that way. And if you listen to episode one, and Jamal Thomas, man, coming up with knowing that Clarence Thomas is your dad. I mean, the reason that he was famous in the first place is embarrassing, but then to be seen as a traitor amongst your own people, and it would be fair to assume, if you listen to the episode, his mother's listening to MSNBC, it's fair to assume they might not share his politics. I would just like to know how that relationship forms, because, I mean, obviously, you know, Clarence Thomas is very much a man's man. He believes in male relationships. So I wonder how that's a part of his life that I can't touch, that I would love to touch someday.
Yeah, like I have been struck through these two episodes. He's just way more interesting than I expected. This is independent of any judgment of him, but like listening to the ways that people talk about him, like, I had never thought much of Clarence Thomas as any particular type of human being, right? Like, not that he wasn't human, but he just served for what he was, right? And like hearing some of these details, and some of them that are incredibly relatable and understandable if you spend any time in the Deep South and around people who grew up fairly similar to him, and also his reactions to like turning up in these white spaces and the ways that he ultimately wound up getting treated once he got there, which is always interesting to me, because I think for you and I, we both kind of started playing that beat around the white folks game a little bit early. I never felt the rejection or being patronized in the ways that he describes that he did when he showed up at all these places. Maybe I was just too stupid or cocky to recognize it. Well, you know, what I mean?
I was going to ask you. So, yeah, because you've been in that situation before. Did you ever resent being in those sort of situations or whatever? Like, did that ever?
No, like when I, you know, because like, you know, going to school in Waller and being who I was in that place, I was in the weird space with them, though, where I was the kid with money and we weren't rich. Right. You know what I mean? Like even amongst the white people or whatever it was, like I was in a little different one. When I got to Claremont, it was interesting because I didn't really interact with people. And so who knows what they thought of me? Like I'm 21 when I show up there, you know, and I'm kicking it like 21-year-old black dudes in 2001 and 2002 and 2003 kick it. But I would watch if I get up and do a presentation and the eyes would just blow up and they just couldn't believe that, oh, wow, the kid is actually out here thugging, you know, like they can't believe this thing happened. But I never felt insulted or any of those things. Like I never had that part. The you're only here because ... I personally never felt that. And again, maybe it's because I'm built with a different sort of confidence that I never would expect it. Like, I don't think no woman I meet is with me for no money neither. I don't think about it like that.
So nobody's ever been able to puncture your confidence in that way?
No, only thing that ever punctured my confidence was microeconomics at the graduate school level. It wasn't nothing nobody said to me. It was like, damn, this is hard.
Well, see, I mean, that's the thing. This is really because a lot of people, I mean, are always talking about that rejection that they experience when in a majority white space for their whole life. You know what I'm saying? Like, they never get over it, and it totally affects the way that they see other people. And Clarence Thomas, you can just see that. In addition, I mean, the thing that's sort of fascinated me is that he holds black people to a much higher standard. I mean, these were children that were making fun of him and his skin color and everything else, but they were children. But yes, he doesn't hold white people that offended him and talked about his skin color and, you know, turn out the lights, Clarence, so we can see you, that sort of stuff. He doesn't hold them to the same sort of standard. And I have some theories about why that may be that we'll get into later in the series. But it obviously hurt him. And I was kind of like you, like I have a lot of confidence in myself. So it didn't quite affect me quite the same way, but you still don't want to go through it, right? Like you just don't want to hear people. You don't want to have to deal with those assumptions. And obviously it hits people a lot different. And Clarence Thomas is a very sensitive dude, man. He has a lot of enemies. And so he's going to be holding that kind of stuff that happened on him forever. With somebody like Bomani Jones, it's like, I don't care, man. Well, you know what I'm saying? I know where I'm at. I know where I belong to be here.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We talked about this just a little bit, but I do think it's really something to come back to. You think about a guy historically, like, say, Booker T. Washington, who a lot of people viewed as being an Uncle Tom, but also you have his defenders who I think make the fair point that he probably was a bit of a realist, right? Growing up as he grew up, where he grew up, there was an understanding of the limitations of how far. Like, there's an Avon Barksdale quality to him, where you could make the argument that in the eyes of some, W.E.B. Du Bois is Stringer Bell. Now, W.E.B. Du Bois, obviously, much smarter than Stringer Bell. I'm not saying Stringer Bell is W.E.B. Du Bois, right? I want to be very, very
We never want people to make that.
Yes, no, we will not. I mean, everybody to get that. Everybody to understand that. But Avon Barksdale understood just the gangster, I suppose, right? This the game they got for us to play. And this the game that we going to play. And all your dreams about taking this game over to the other place, they never going to let you get over there. And Stringer Bell found that out the hard way. Now, it's not an apples to apples in terms of what Du Bois thought was possible, though he did wind up at the end being like, oh, wow, I guess this isn't going to be the way that I thought it was. But Clarence Thomas, unlike Booker T. Washington, where you can make the argument of why it is that he is the way it is, and this could be seen as some affection for us as a people, right? Clarence, just wall to wall, ain't nobody here for you. Across the board, there is no yeah, but among Black people when it's time to have the Clarence Thomas discussion. And I don't care how far he's gone to like excommunicate himself from Black people. I can't imagine how hurting and hurtful that has to be for that man.
Oh, but he's deeply wounded by that. You're absolutely right. Like, he has never gotten over it. And I'm not going to say that it drives his jurisprudence, because his, political ideology is sort of fixed. Like, I think that he's sort of more of a finished product earlier in his life than people think. This is something that wounds him and he cries about. And I mean, he's been talking about this, things that happened to him and being rejected by the Black community since the 80s, man. Like, this is more than half his life. He's known that people are not very happy with him and they think of him as a traitor. And I mean, I guess the issue is, like, at the end of the day, does it matter to him? Oh, ultimately, he's like, well, he can credibly argue that he has won,
Does it matter if you ain't got the people you want on your own side with you, right? Because there's a cynicism that seems present in all of his actions really since the mid 1970s. Like, I don't think he thought that it would get him to the Supreme Court necessarily, but he knew it would get him places.
A good job. He'll be taken care of. Yes.
Right. And so he does this interview with Juan Williams and his life takes off really after that, because it's so few Black people willing to get in front of people and say that stuff. All you got to do is actually do it. Do you know how much money I could make if I went Hollywood Hogan NWO on it?
That
would make $100 million a year if I was willing to say what Clarence Thomas said.
I mean, YouTube would do something with you, Spotify. You know what I mean? Like, it's a wide open lane. It's very seductive. Like, all you got to do is walk through it. Right. We both know Don Calloway, right?
Yes.
Shout out Don. He was on Twitter a few years ago talking about how that, he used to be a Democratic legislator in Missouri. And he talked about there was a point in his life where the Republicans were waving that cash in front of him, man. It was like, hey, man, you come over here, line is shorter, we can take care of you, And I mean, you hear that from a lot of people in Capitol Hill, that like the Republicans are paying, bro. Thing is, it's very seductive, man. I mean, it's very seductive to people, and we know that it's out there. And Don Calloway talked about, there are people out there that will pay you to say these things and take these positions if you're willing to do it. And I guess
Have to pay Clarence to say it.
Yeah.
I mean, but he came about this ideology honestly, right? Like, he came about it himself. And then I think he looked up and kind of figured out. It's like I say about Flavor Flav, but he was on Flavor of Love. I didn't think he was as much as he was just kind of like this, and they built a show around it. And what are you supposed to do, right? Like, say I'm a natural, right? He's like, no, I'm gonna take this bread, and I'm gonna go do it. I mean, that's what people were saying about him, though, right?
Yeah,
but with Clarence, it was not hard to find the through line to his views, and like Kwame Brown, who is from that same little part of Georgia over there where he is. And if you watch any of the stuff he's talking about on YouTube, it's logically and ideologically the same things.
Same stuff.
It's the same stuff. And it don't sound like no white man told him to say it. It sounds like a whole lot of black people that I've met at various points. The difference between Clarence Thomas and those other black men is even those black men would probably get up and feel like, yo, these white folks is using me. And that I don't think Clarence cared about at all.
No, I don't. I mean, but it's obviously paid off for him. But there are a lot of people like that, man. I mean, I shouldn't say a lot because we know what the numbers are. But there are enough people out there like that that know that they can take the money and they'll be taken care of. Right. And I mean, Clarence Thomas has obviously made that calculation and it has really, really worked out for him. But again, this is a person who has like affection. He has like he is of the black community, and to have that kind of distance from it, I don't think that he'll die and feel good about his relationship to the black folks.
No. You know what I want to know about Clarence Thomas as we wrap this up? Mm. And I'm kind of being silly, but I'm actually kind of being serious. Mm-hmm. What you think his record collection look like? Like, do you think that there's an inflection point where you can find when he started just kicking it with all these white folks, and then all of a sudden what's in the collection changed and started flipping over?
Yeah. Well, you know, so the thing is that I don't know what Jenny Thomas is into, right? Like, so that kind of, but before that, this is Motown. You know, I mean, he's a Motown dude, man. You know what I'm saying? And liked all the soul classics, you know what I'm saying? He was on the George Benson's version of, you know, I Believe Children Are Free. What's the name of that song? The Greatest Love of All.
That's what it
is. Yeah, that's it. I mean, that was his joint. You know what I'm saying? So he was into that. But yeah, I mean, now, I mean, when you go to Harlan Crow, well, you know, actually, if you go to a Harlan Crow hangout, don't you think they would probably be playing Motown? That probably is like the easiest, most offensive. I don't think
they're
playing
rock music.
It might be
some of it. I may not be playing rock
music. Racist white people love Motown.
Yeah, true. But something tell me that Boo Scootin' Boogie, Clarence know all the words to all them joints. Like that's where, like, I get the feeling that if Clarence made a heel turn on music, they don't just go to white music. They go to really bad white music. And I'd also like to note, in fairness to Clarence Thomas, I've seen no evidence that he ever had the box haircut. And all them cats that fit his profile, almost all of them get a box.
I want to say something about this because it's an episode 3, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. We talked to somebody who knew him at a time, and it said it looked, she said it looked like he had cut his hair with like a butter knife or something like that. Like he did. Oh, it was clear.
Okay.
It was clear that he did not go to the barber.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You know, so he did have it in him.
He did have it. Yeah.
He
yeah,
did.
Yeah.
Is that person in that same interview, the one that told you that one thing that I've been shaken yes. by since
yeah,
you told
yeah,
me?
Yeah. I mean, I ain't even sent you.
Did that make the episode?
You just can't.
I'm not going to say it. No. You could tell. You could tell me if it makes the episode now. No,
it doesn't.
Everybody else needs to hear it.
It's too. Yeah. You listen to the podcast. There'll be stuff. There's some good stuff. This is a woman that dated him in the 80s. I can say that much. And we talked to her for episode 3. And I mean,
she admitted that she dated Clarence Thomas as a black person.
I mean, look, bro.
I see you.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, look, and not just she enthusiastically dated Clarence Thomas. It wasn't just that she dated him. Enthusiastically dated him.
So. Yes, Clarence got game, mate. Like this is this. We need to make the Clarence Thomas movie. That's like the fun Clarence Thomas movie.
I mean, the dude actually. I mean, am I gonna get in trouble saying it? He sounds like a person for whom we've all hung out with a lot. You know what I mean? Yes. Like, he seems like a pretty cool dude. But it's just like, all right, man. Do you really believe this?
He's guy in the barbershop. Like, people don't understand. Yeah. That guy is in the barbershop, and he's usually not alone. He's just alone and being willing to say it.
Man, look, man. We had somebody like that in one of my group chats a couple years ago, man. We had to kick out because after January 6th, it was kind of, I mean, if you go still be on that side, it's like, all right, bro, it's time for you to go. But and we all know that person, man. It don't mean they don't love black people. It don't mean they don't like being around black people. It just means that they may just be more skeptical of white people than even the most skeptical of us.
There it is. But hey, man, that's Joel Addison. Check it out. Slow Burn Season 9, available wherever you get your podcast from Slate. Get on it. It is. You're killing it. Like, it was so funny that I had just sent you a text the other day telling you that you was killing it. And then Spencer sent me a text being like, yo, Joel is killing it. And so man, I took a screen cap of that and put it in the group text that me, you and Spencer have.
Nah, man, look, I appreciate it. Well, let me just say, because I mean, I didn't get a chance to talk about the show. I didn't get to talk about the live show. Man, I'm just proud of you, man. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, appreciate
I know we joke with each other, you know what I'm saying? But this is, I mean, a deep level of respect between us. You're a good friend of mine, man, and I'm just really proud of everything you've been doing, bro. So,
I wish
I could have been at the live show. You know what I'm saying? I could have had your boys zoom in or something.
Nah, man, what you need to do is start talking to these people, see if they can take us on the road, man. We had people. I'll talk more about it on Friday with Dominique, man. We had people lined up around the block an hour before showtime.
Oh, come on out to the Bay, man. We'll take care of you.
Yeah, if I say I don't know if I can afford to rent on one day in the Bay. You know what I'm saying?
Stop it, man. Stop
but I'm
it,
down. Bro. Yeah, I do that. You can bring my little nephew up there. You know what,
man,
I'm saying?
We love him. I'll bring him up there. Got his little TCU onesie. You know what I'm saying? You take a picture with him. It'll be nice.
I just sent him a gift.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to it. Did y'all see that in the YouTube thing? By the way, oh, sorry.
60. What was it? 60 what?
Hey, man, you got to be in the game. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but was it?
I don't want to hear from somebody who rooted for a team.
Help, because I can't remember. It was in the 60s, right? Was it? I'm serious. Mm-hmm. Was it in the 60s?
I mean, it was the national championship game. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
it was in the 60s. It was in the 60s in the national championship game, right?
Yeah. You've rooted for a team that is.
And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us on the right time. We do this 3 times a week. Dan Stasic, Parker Owens, Adi Khan, handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow the right time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You put 62 points on us, I might be inclined to think you're a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. 63 points.
Get that man 3 stars for me.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.